From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, doling out road repair dollars. Are Democratic districts getting a fair share?
There are a lot of people, a lot of Democrats, who are saying, you know, don't stand there and say, oh, you know, woe is me, I have to talk about the politics, when it was very political the first time around.
Is Michigan ready to turn a new leaf on pot?
There are other social uses applied to cannabis today that I think people open their minds to when they think about down the street somebody using medical cannabis or even in their homes.
We look at America's rocky road to legalization, and we look at snorkeling in Michigan.
You're not going to back into something prickly, or you don't have to worry about anything. Everything there is absolutely safe.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. It's been a rocky road for the marijuana legalization movement. We've got this crazy quilt of state laws permitting use of cannabis for medical purposes, two states allowing people to use it recreationally, and a federal law that says, no, you can't. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, how did we get to this unusual patchwork of state laws on pot? And are we truly looking at the impending end of another era of prohibition? But first, continuing our week-long look at the new state budget, more than $53 billion affecting every aspect of life in Michigan. Today, everybody's pet sore subject, roads and transportation. Crane's Detroit Business Capital reporter Chris Gouts is here. Chris, we know what we aren't getting, that $1 billion the governor says it'll take to fix Michigan's roads.
That's right. That's what we're not getting. What we are getting is, you know, pretty much what we got, you know, in the years previous. There really isn't much of an increase this year in the budget. There's roughly $100 million overall more in the budget and about $280 million of new money that comes out of the general fund. But that's largely just to meet, you know, federal matching dollars, just so we can keep getting all of the federal money that we're entitled to. And so it's kind of a ho-hum budget. It's just going to continue to sort of help us plot along and continue to try as best we can to maintain the level of roads that we have in Michigan, which are largely fair and in some cases much worse.
Lawmakers headed off to summer vacations without figuring out how to raise that $1 billion. When do you think they'll get back to this issue?
Well, you know, they say that they wanted to, you know, do some work groups throughout the summer and the fall. I haven't heard of any of that going on. It's possible that things might be happening. But I would really doubt that you would see any real concerted activity between the primary election and the general election. So more than likely, you're talking about a lame duck situation. And then, as we know, with right to work and other things, you know, anything can happen. It'll depend on the outcome of the election as well. And it's really going to come down to, are the votes going to be there? Because if they're not, then they won't try it. They're going to really have to take the temperature to figure out if they found enough votes for the deal that they thought that they had, you know, before they left for summer break, or if they come up with some new ingenious plan that will bring out some new votes. I think that's kind of where we're headed, and some people aren't all that optimistic that anything will get done.
Governor Snyder signed that supplemental funding bill in March that gave lawmakers a $115 million kitty for special road projects. And I remember you and I talked about this the last time this happened. Most of that special funding went to districts represented by Republicans, and Democrats cried foul. What happened this time around?
Pretty much the same thing, only Democrats fare just a little bit better. I think out of the $115 million, about $41 million went to districts that were represented in some part by Democrats. And in announcing the projects, you know, Speaker Boulder sort of lamented the fact that he even had to bring up the notion that, you know, Democrats got this amount of money. Well, I mean, it was his office who purposely left out Democrats from participating in the process a year ago. So there are a lot of people, a lot of Democrats, who are saying, you know, don't stand there and say, oh, you know, woe is me, I have to talk about the politics, when it was very political the first time around. And it was somewhat political the second time, although not as blatant.
And really, isn't that $115 million just a drop in the bucket for what's really needed?
it's not even a drop. It's so small and minuscule that, you know, it's not even sometimes in some points worth mentioning unless you live in one of those districts. I personally happen to live in a district where one of the roads that is going to get fixed, and that is great news for me. But for somebody in another part of the state who's not getting any money, maybe if they're represented completely by Democrats, you know, they're not going to see anything, and they're wondering why their roads aren't as important. So, it's just a small thing, and it's going to be some great press releases that have already gone out, and it's going to be some work that's going to get done in districts right before the election, because the money will come in August, and some of the work's already started. Some will start when they get their money, and so there'll be some orange barrels, you know, come election season, and a lot of people, a lot of Democrats and others who are watching this are thinking, you know, that's kind of what the intention was.
Chris, the Secretary of State got some money in this upcoming new budget to help crack down on phony insurance certificates. What's that about?
Yeah, this was a subject that Secretary of State Ruth Johnson came up with last year in working with the state police, because they were finding just rampant fraud throughout the state, not just in Detroit, but really across the state. In one day, they decided to look at, you know, folks who were bringing in paper certificates, either thinking that they had auto insurance and purchased it from somebody doing a con on them, or they purchased it knowing that they really didn't have insurance and just hoping that it would sneak by. But in one day, they found about 17% of the certificates that came into the Secretary of State's office to verify insurance were actually fraudulent. In one really blatant case, somebody had purchased an insurance policy that they thought was good, and it had a QR code on it, you know, those funny-looking things that you can scan your smartphone on, and it takes you to a website, so it made it look very official. But when you actually did the work and you scanned the QR code, it took you to a website that had a picture of a llama, and it said, and the website just said, "Llamas are so cool." I mean, it was so blatant. And so there's going to be some money in the budget, about $1.5 million, that's going to try to help combat some of that fraud and help make sure that doesn't happen again, and making sure consumers are aware, but also enabling the state to hire some additional folks to help people out who have those fraudulent policies, and also go after those who are selling these illegal policies.
Chris Gouts, Capital Reporter for Crane's Detroit Business. As always, thanks, Chris.
Thank you.
And tomorrow, we continue piecing together the new state budget as we look at how much money is flowing to public safety. Michigan is indeed the water wonderland. We think of fishing, boating, swimming, but snorkeling? Nancy Washburn has snorkeled around the world, from the Great Barrier Reef to the Solomon Islands, but her book is titled Snorkeling Guide to Michigan Inland Lakes. Nancy Washburn, welcome to Stateside.
Well, thank you, Cindy.
Snorkeling in Michigan Inland Lakes, how did you discover good snorkeling here?
Well, it was a total accident. My son was 12 years old, and he wanted to go camping. And my husband did not want to participate. He said, "I don't like the camp routine, ants and things like that." So I said, "Well, I'll go with you if I can take my snorkel and mask," because I didn't know if there'd be anything under there or not. And when I looked down, I was stupefied. I could not believe how gorgeous it was.
What did you think it would be like as you first went into an inland lake, Nancy?
I really didn't. I didn't know what to think, because having had such wonderful experiences at the Great Barrier Reef and the Red Sea and the Caribbean and all over, it was like going into an aquarium. They were incredibly good. But the thing that they did not have, that Michigan's Inland Lake has, is that you can go back to the very same spot that you were snorkeling in the day before. So say if a bullhead has babies or whatever, you can go back the next day and see how the babies are doing, if they're growing, and what it looks like. And I did not expect to be able to get such wonderful pictures. And, of course, unless you go to a clear lake, you won't get those. You won't get that, but I found enough. I think there were over a thousand. I did over 1,000 lakes, and there were, I think, 300 or so that were exceptionally good. So it was very, very exciting.
Take us underwater with you. Why try snorkeling in Michigan? What will we see?
Well, a lot of it, if you looked at it, you would think you were looking at National Geographic. I mean, it's not just, it's better than anything I saw in the Red Sea. And I'd say the Red Sea is probably pretty hard to top. It was more exciting. There was more color. And, of course, the fish in freshwater are very different. If you look, turn on your TV, it's practically all ocean. Unless you were looking at the Amazon, you're not really going to see any of the television shows will not show you freshwater. So that's why I have approximately 800 hours of underwater video. And it's all very... I couldn't believe what was down there. Just great clarity, and you never know what's going to swim by.
And you don't have to worry about a shark or that ucky salt water.
That's another thing I love about it. You don't have to, you're not going to back into something prickly, or you don't have to worry about anything. Everything there is absolutely safe. So that gives a feeling of calmness to you when you're doing it. You don't have to look here or look there or wonder if you're going to be attacked or run into something unpleasant. The only thing is, you can't lose weight that way. I think you use up about 60 calories an hour because you have to be very quiet or not move around, or you won't have any fish around. You'll scare them all away. So you just sort of lie there and they come to you. You'll have 50, 60 fish around you in moments. And it's just something that I've done a lot of programs for all of the Trout Unlimited and the DNR, and they are shocked themselves. They'll give me a call and they'll say, well, guess what? We just put 10,000 walleye into the river or lake or whatever, if you want to come and see it. So they were very cooperative in telling me what was happening where, what they were planting in the water. And it's just, I don't exactly know. Once I saw that there was interesting stuff there, I just kept going and going and going and going and going. And it took me about probably 5 or 6 years to do every inland lake.
For more information, you can go to snorkelmichigan.com. Nancy Washburn's book is Snorkeling Guide to Michigan Inland Lakes. Nancy, thank you so much for taking us underwater.
Well, thank you for the offer. It's great to be able to share it.
I'm Cynthia Canty, and this is Stateside. What we commonly think of as Prohibition began in 1920. It was the start of the federal government completely and utterly failing to keep citizens from drinking alcohol. It took 13 years for the tide to turn against Prohibition and for the 21st Amendment to make it legal to drink alcohol again. And now it seems that we're at a similar point in our history when it comes to cannabis. Voters in 23 states, including Michigan and the District of Columbia, have said yes to medical marijuana laws. And in November 2012, voters in Washington and Colorado made recreational pot use legal, at least as far as state law is concerned. Today's attitudes toward marijuana are truly changing. When and how did this begin? And are we really looking at the impending end of another era of prohibition? These are questions posed in a new book by investigative journalists Allison Martin and Nushin Rashidian. The title, A New Leaf, The End of Cannabis Prohibition. Allison Martin and Nushin Rashidian are with us now from New York. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Allison, I'll start with you. What inspired you guys to pile into a red Volkswagen Beetle and hit the road for 3 years, 30,000 miles, and hundreds of interviews for this book?
Yeah, that's a great question. I still wonder myself sometimes. I'm from upstate New York, and I was very curious after visiting Southern California and seeing on Venice Beach very open cannabis use, cannabis consumption, recommendation clinics, and these sorts of things. And, you know, I asked Nushin, how can this possibly be legal? And she said to me, you know, and she's from Southern California, you know, I don't really know. And that was kind of the beginning of the thread that I continued to pull for a while. And, you know, my background is in health journalism, and I saw a real opportunity to explore the health and medical components and aspects of cannabis. And really, it was just a great opportunity as a journalist to really cover something that was pretty untapped at the time. We started working on this in 2009. And, you know, our goal was really to capture the moment in time. It was a really drastic shift that was happening very quickly between 2009, 2010, and about 2012, and it's still happening pretty rapidly.
Yes, we're certainly seeing that in Michigan. Nushin, I want to talk terminology. you guys call it cannabis throughout the book. And I'm wondering, why did you choose to not use that common term marijuana?
Sure. If you look back at texts and conversations basically before, you know, the Marijuana Tax Act passed in 1937 and started the prohibition, the common term used to describe this plant was cannabis, or in some cases hemp, Indian hemp, or the hemp plant. So really the term marijuana came about in the 30s when we were, as a country, kind of evaluating outlawing the plant and associating it with immigrants and these sort of minority populations. And really there was this like fear factor of, well, look at these people, look at these, in this case it was Mexicans, look at them and this marijuana that they're smoking. And a lot of people actually had no idea that this horrible, horrifying marijuana that they were bringing in was the same cannabis and Indian hemp that they were using for birdseed, they were using for medical tinctures. There was a really strong miscommunication at the time. So we decided to go with the term that researchers use, that scientists use, that is a more common term used across the globe, cannabis. Even though cannabis includes hemp, we still felt like it was a better term than sticking with marijuana, which seems in many cases to have very racist roots.
You take us back in history, and you touched on this, Nusheen, reminding us that cannabis extracts and tinctures were used not only in the United States, but also in Europe.
This is true, right? So, yeah, cannabis has been used as a medicine across the globe for thousands of years. And where it started its migration west, I guess you would say, was, you know, when you had the English basically looking and observing the use in India. And they started noticing that they were using it as a medicine. And there was actually an Irish physician named William O'Shaughnessy who observed the use of cannabis in India and from there brought tinctures to England. And from there, it spread to eastern U.S. There was cannabis tinctures being sold in New York. I mean, so there was a time where cannabis was in the pharmacopoeia till the 40s, early 40s. And it was only in the process of prohibition that they had to make a strong argument during the legislation for the Marijuana Tax Act that, oh, well, you know, the medical uses are not common enough, not convincing enough for us to keep this plant legal. So, you know, and obviously it never really went away. Research continued, and we saw medical cannabis pretty much start making its comeback in the 70s.
And what was happening in the United States when the push to make cannabis illegal began?
You know, what's really fascinating, it was the turn of the 20th century, and this idea of temperance was very popular. And one thing that Allison and I really thought about when we were writing the book was it was so strange that as a country we declared alcohol prohibition a failure and then thought, hey, this is a good idea. Let's, you know, embark on another prohibition. So basically it was just the attitude of the time. You had a fear of these substances. You had a fear of minorities. You had this move toward outlawing substances. And that all started at the turn of the 20th century with alcohol, with cannabis, with opiates, with, you know, cocaine. So it was just a mood that took over.
If I could jump in for a second, yeah, I think Nusheen summed it up pretty well. But, you know, the prohibitionist ideology that swept the country, it, you know, what we say in the book is that it was pretty easy to add another boxcar with cannabis with the tracks already laid. You know, there were no good substances at the time, especially intoxicating ones.
When did the push toward medical use begin? So they basically to try to take the boxcar off the track.
So this is Allison. So in the 70s, there was a young speechwriter, and this was kind of the first attempt to bring back medical cannabis. And in the 70s, a young man in his 20s named Robert Randall discovered that he had glaucoma. He lived in D.C. Long story short, he realized, you know, through the process of consuming cannabis one night that the joint actually reduced and or removed some of the halos that he saw as a result of the glaucoma. You know, as anybody would who was, you know, a young guy who didn't want to go blind, he was told that he'd go blind by 30. You know, he started consuming cannabis. Eventually, he was arrested, and he went to Normal to seek help fighting the federal government for his right to consume cannabis. He actually won. He's one of the few people who can say, you know, he fought the law and he won, at least with regard to cannabis federally. And, you know, what's interesting about him is that, you know, when we look at medical cannabis today, you know, across the country, really, it goes back to Robert Randall in the 70s. You know, as a result of Randall, there was a federal program that was implemented where people could receive tins of cannabis joints. And, you know, eventually that program was shut down, but several people are still grandfathered into the program and still receive joints of cannabis from the federal farm in Mississippi today. So, you know, the more recent medical cannabis, as we know, it started in 1996 in California with their law that passed, which, you know, when we look at medical cannabis today, it's the landscape is very, very different across the country. And, you know, part of the reason people look at California and say, you know, oh, we don't want to become like California. The reason California became like California is because their law was actually only a page long. If you take a look at the laws that are passing most recently, they're tens, if not hundreds of pages long. So, yeah, that's kind of how we started to dismantle prohibition as far as medical cannabis goes.
And then did that in turn give an acceleration toward legalizing recreational use?
That's a tough question to answer. You know, I think medical cannabis does soften people to the idea of social use cannabis. You know, if you know somebody in your family who has or had cancer or glaucoma or, you know, HIV or AIDS, any of these conditions for which, you know, cannabis is a pretty proven therapy for, you know, anti-emetic, you know, reducing pain and these sorts of things, it's hard to remain hard toward medical cannabis. You know, if you are looking on the news every night or reading newspapers and thinking about family members or friends who use cannabis for medical purposes, it does start to, I think, open people's minds to other areas where drug law reform could possibly be useful, such as you know, mass incarceration, mandatory minimums. You know, there are other social uses applied to cannabis today that I think people open their minds to when they think about, you know, down the street, somebody using medical cannabis or even in their homes.
If you've just joined us, we're speaking with writers Nooshin Rashidian and Allison Martin. Their book is The End of Cannabis Prohibition, A New Leaf. So here we are in 2014. We have this crazy quilt of state laws that permit use of cannabis for medical purposes. We have two states allowing people to use it recreationally, and then a federal law that says, no, you can't. How do we get here?
So that's part of what led to us wanting to write this book. We've got four stances in the country, as you mentioned: medical, social, prohibition, and decriminalization. And that patchwork is frustrating for a lot of people. And it's what led to, when we were reporting the book, what we called the clash. You know, we witnessed, as we were reporting, you know, directly some effects of that clash. You know, people that we interviewed weeks later were raided, and now one person is still in prison, and other people faced, you know, seized assets. Other people's businesses were completely shuttered. Caregiver clinics were shut down. It was a fascinating time to be reporting for this book. Nooshin, I don't know if you want to jump in as well.
Sure. Yeah, I think we got here because cannabis prohibition lasted, you know, 75 years versus the 13 years that we had for alcohol prohibition. And I think that we're not looking just at ending cannabis prohibition. This is really the sort of beginning of dismantling what a lot of people think is a failed war on drugs. So I think that it's a very slow process. And it's going to continue to be a very slow and messy process. And we might end up with a patchwork for a very long time, for generations, in the same way that you have dry counties with alcohol. That just might always be the case. But I think that a lot of the complication, a lot of the mess, though, comes from having almost a majority of the states at this point pushing against a federal government that basically has been unwilling to budge and has been pushing back, though it seems like that tide is starting to turn. So it's going to be like this state by state. It's going to be like this at the federal level. And it's going to be pretty complicated internationally, as we see, you know, Uruguay and other Latin American countries saying, hey, you know, we also don't want to fight this drug war anymore. We also want to legalize cannabis. So this is going to be a pretty interesting global shift.
Here in Michigan, as I touched on earlier, voters have already approved the medical marijuana law. And then there are softened laws on the books in 9 Michigan cities. That includes Detroit and Lansing, Flint and more. And we're expecting there'll be ballot proposals to legalize or decriminalize cannabis in some 20 communities all over the state. But then even when those local ordinances pass, police say, well, it's still not legal on the state and the federal level. Is this a case of supporters of legal cannabis working from the inside out?
Michigan is interesting, and I think it's taken the form of a lot of other states where some of the reform or push for reform starts with, you know, individual towns and counties that are perhaps more progressive on the issue.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Michigan is a really unique case because you don't see really any other state in the eastern part of the country with Michigan's, you know, medical cannabis makeup. It's very, you know, as many would say, the Wild West. It's very California or Oregon or you know, how Washington was with just their medical system, where, you know, one example is, you know, High Times wants to bring their cannabis cup to Michigan. There's just this, a very broad segment of the population that supports this, yet what's very fascinating is that they still have what I guess you would consider a very old caregiver-based medical cannabis model. So I think that Michigan is definitely one of the states that's going to be ripe for cannabis legislation. It seems like the people are ready for it, you know, as evidenced by the fact that there are shops and medical cannabis businesses thriving when there's no legislation on the books saying they can. You know, that's definitely a pattern that people saw in Colorado, Washington, again, Oregon, California, these states that have forged ahead and are pushing for legalization. So I think Michigan is probably one of the first states this far east that's going to possibly go the cannabis legalization route.
Is this an issue that you've seen not just here in Michigan but across the country? Does it bring together and unite people from all political viewpoints and many different backgrounds?
I think that cannabis is interesting because it's becoming more and more purple by the day. I mean, you can't really say it's a Democratic issue. You can't really say it's a Republican issue. It's both, and it's also libertarian. You know, of course, now that hemp is involved, the industrial hemp production, you've got some really interesting states that are showing great deal of interest. You know, down south in states like Kentucky and Tennessee, you know, who would have thought that they would be, you know, leading the efforts for hemp?
Based on what you've seen, what you've heard through all these months of interviews and traveling, I'd like both of your thoughts on, do you see the day when cannabis will be legalized in the United States the way alcohol became legal again in 1933? And if so, when do you think that will happen?
So here's kind of how I think about where this country could be with cannabis legalization. I think the day very much could come when cannabis is legal for everybody in all states. And I think there will be, you know, certain counties and cities and, you know, municipalities that will have moratoriums. But I kind of liken it to a cruise ship and that, you know, this has been a very, very, very slow turn. So, you know, of course, it's unpredictable which way it's going to go, but we're very clearly witnessing a turn here. It hasn't been very quick. You know, this country's been working on drug law reform as far as medical cannabis since 1996. So, you know, I think the slow turn is going to continue. And I think that, you know, the federal government is softening to both medical and social use cannabis. I think medical cannabis is going to be a lot easier for the federal government to swallow. But yeah, you know, to pinpoint a date, I mean, I would really be pretty much like setting myself up for an incorrect, you know, kind of prediction here. But yeah, I certainly do think that there, you know, will be a day where, you know, drug law reform or cannabis law reform will take it to a point where it's legal.
Fair enough. You want to add to that, Nushin?
Yeah, I think a majority of Americans are tired of cannabis prohibition. And I think that if we see in Colorado and Washington and other states to come that the tax revenue is being well spent, that these businesses are being kept in check, that youth and adult use isn't rising, and there aren't, you know, tons of traffic fatalities, I think that, you know, slowly, state by state, you will see the country go toward cannabis legalization. And eventually, I think the last stop on that train is going to be, you know, the federal government kind of moving out of the way. And the sooner they do so, though, obviously, the easier it's going to be for these states because they need, you know, banks willing to take their money. They need, you know, they need access to some of these areas where the federal prohibition gets in the way.
The book is A New Leaf, The End of Cannabis Prohibition, and we've been speaking with the authors Nooshin Rashidian and Allison Martin. Good talking with both of you. Thank you so much.
It's been fantastic. Thank you very much.
About 2 months ago, we told you about that 80-year-old agave plant at the University of Michigan. It was getting ready to flower. And that flowering would be a once-in-a-lifetime event, because after it's done flowering, the agave plant will die. Word from the Mathai Botanical Gardens is the agave began to bloom Tuesday afternoon. So far, the blooms are pretty low-key, but it's clear the 27-foot agave has begun its swan song. Before the plant dies, it will produce genetic clones, and the experts at Mathai will be using those to make sure the 80-year-old plant lives on. Welcome back to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Michigan Radio's The Environment Report just wrapped up a week-long series called Michigan's Silent Poison. Reporter Rebecca Williams worked in partnership with the Center for Public Integrity and the public radio show Reveal, exploring the problem of arsenic in well water. Rebecca Williams is here with us again. Rebecca, recap for us just what you learned through your reporting.
In Michigan, we have a serious arsenic problem in private wells. Arsenic causes cancer, and it's been linked to a number of other serious health problems. And if you're on city water, there are federal standards that limit the amount of arsenic in the water. But if you're on a private well, there are no standards like that. So what's important to know is that the Thumb region of Michigan has some of the highest arsenic levels in the state in private wells. There are wells with 5, 10, even 20 times the amount of arsenic that's considered acceptable for public water sources by the EPA. And Oakland, Washtenaw, and Ingham counties are also among those that have higher arsenic levels. So one of the things that we looked at is whose job is it to make sure that people know about this?
Rebecca, as you were putting this series together, you made several attempts to speak with someone from the Michigan Department of Community Health and really didn't get anywhere. After the series aired, we heard from the DCH, and they said they would make an expert available to speak. The expert they recommended joins us now. Jennifer Gray is a toxicologist with the Michigan Department of Community Health. Thank you for joining us today, Jennifer.
Thank you for asking.
Well, Rebecca, I know that your reporting really led to a lot of questions, so let me invite you to take some time now that we have with Jennifer and see if you can get some of these questions sorted out.
Well, Jennifer, I wanted to ask you, the EPA put out a draft report on cancer risks from arsenic in 2008, and in that report they said that arsenic is 17 times more potent as a carcinogen than previously thought. Given that information, what is the state's responsibility to make sure that people know that they should test their wells for arsenic?
So I guess I'm going to answer a little bit of a different question than you're asking, because the Michigan Department of Community Health doesn't have any drinking water program for that. It's handled under local health departments, and public water supplies, of course, are under the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality. In terms of informing people of locations with higher arsenic, that is one thing that we do in our regular site assessment work when we do have information about areas that could have higher arsenic. We do want people to know that information, and we do encourage people to work with their local health departments on getting their private wells tested, both for arsenic and any other contaminants or chemicals that happen to be an issue in their area that their local health departments can assist them with.
There was a burst of attention about a decade ago when awareness of arsenic in Michigan first surfaced and when the EPA reduced how much arsenic could be in drinking water. But it seems that in our reporting that awareness of high arsenic levels in Michigan has really fallen off the radar for a lot of people. Why do you think that is?
Honestly, there I couldn't answer that. There are a lot of local health departments that when they do have newer wells or put in that they do have arsenic testing done. Other places do have laws about property transfers. And again, we certainly notify people when we do have the data from their area that there could be an arsenic issue.
Well, and Jennifer, you mentioned the differences in local health departments, and you're right about that, but I found that really they vary really widely, especially in these high arsenic counties in terms of how they handle the issue. Some counties, as you mentioned, do have point-of-sale programs and some require testing of new wells, but there are others like Lapeer and Genesee where arsenic levels can be especially high that don't require any testing. Why does this responsibility fall to county health departments that might have a lack of funds or lack of people to address this?
You know, and I'm sorry about this question. I have no idea what the transfer was of authority for drinking water through the DEQ back when it did happen. So I really, this is beyond what I could answer because the private wells did get moved over to the local health departments.
One of the things that was brought up to me by a county health official was that we have a radon awareness month in Michigan in January, but we don't have anything like that for arsenic. Why do you think that is?
That is another excellent question. We don't really have a statewide outreach program. I don't know if it's because of that or not. Again, I'm sorry, this is beyond my area.
Would that, something like that, do you think, Jennifer, does a public outreach awareness like that say, hey, it's Arsenic Awareness Month, would an effort like that by the state really making a big push, and would that make a difference, do you think?
And again, I'm sorry, I'm just a toxicologist, so in terms of an outreach month and the effectiveness of notifying the public on that, I've never seen any statistics on other programs. So I'm not going to be able to answer that question.
One of the things that a number of local county health department officials told us is that they would like the state to take more of a leadership role when it comes to arsenic. And as I guess I'd like to ask you, from your point of view as a toxicologist, are there any changes you would like to see your agency making going forward?
Oh, I'm sorry again. You're asking a toxicologist in the department. I'm not one of the policy people. So that's, again, really beyond my area.
As a toxicologist, Jennifer, how concerned do you believe that people in Michigan should be about that presence of arsenic in their water?
So for people who do have private wells and they may have not been tested, it is important for people to get their wells tested, whether they're in an area with higher arsenic or whether they're in an area that may have other chemicals of concern. So it is important that people be aware of that and get the necessary testing so they do know what's in their private water.
Is there anything else you want people to really grasp about this? I guess, are there things you can tell people, speaking as a toxicologist, to really bring home the importance of following through with this and this knowledge because of what arsenic could do?
Well, arsenic has been linked to the development of cancer, several different types of cancer, and if they do know that their wells are higher, there are systems that can be put in place that will greatly reduce their exposure to arsenic. And so that would be beneficial for their long-term health.
And Rebecca, I know in your reporting you found places and resources that people can go to MichiganRadio.org and go to the Environment Report and find out, for example, if somebody wants to have mom's water tested. There are places to do that, and you steer people to that?
That's right. There's all kinds of information on our website.
Jennifer Gray is a toxicologist with the Michigan Department of Community Health, and Rebecca Williams is with Michigan Radio's The Environment Report. And I want to thank you both so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
And thank you.
We want to answer your questions about Michigan in our new project, Am I Curious? It's a series of stories looking into all the things you've always wondered about our state. Who created the Michigan Left Turn? Why does the state regulate marriage? Why were German POW camps located in Michigan in World War II? Mark Brush is heading up the project at Michigan Radio. Hey, Mark.
Hey, Cindy. How you doing?
Why are we doing this?
Well, this is our chance to kind of pull back the curtain on news production and actually go out into the public and find out what the public is curious about and invite them into the process, the editorial process of developing a story, producing a story, and then airing that story as well. So this is our chance to find out what you are curious about, the public, and then take that question that they ask and produce a story around it.
Why is that important to do?
Well, it's important because here in the newsroom, we have our ideas about what is important and what stories our public are most curious about. But it's really important to invite the public in and kind of get their perspective on the issues. So one neat thing about this project is when somebody asks the question on the website, we can go through how it works in a second. If their question is selected as the one that we're going to investigate, they can come along with us on the story and actually pose questions during an interview. And a lot of times those people will ask questions that we might not think of.
That's very, very interesting. So people can go to michiganradio.org, click on the link that says, what are you curious about, and do what?
Yeah, exactly. So what they do is they go to the website, michiganradio.org, click on what are you curious about, and then that takes you to another website that up in the top bar is a place where you can insert your question. You have 140 characters, so it's like Twitter that way. It makes you focus on what your question is about. Then that question gets entered. You can see it right away. Sometimes people will answer that question in the comment section, and then we as editors will go through those lists of questions, pull three out for a public vote, put those three up for a vote, and the top vote getter is the question we'll investigate for that month.
This is very democratic radio.
It is. That's right.
Mark Brush, thanks so much.
Thank you, Cindy.
So we got our first listener question. Meet Jeff Duncan.
I was very curious about what it was that originally brought people of Arabic or Middle Eastern descent to the state of Michigan.
And Michigan Radio's Sarah Swick went on the search for an answer, and she's here with us now. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Cindy. Good to be here.
Good to have you with us. Why did Jeff want to know about Arabs in Michigan?
Well, his curiosity was piqued mainly because of where he lives, which is in Sterling Heights. It's a suburb in Macomb County, a little bit north of Detroit. And as I describe it in the story, for a long time, it was kind of your pretty typical white middle-class Detroit suburb. But that has changed a lot in recent years, especially in the past decade, largely in part to this influx of largely Arab Americans who are mostly Chaldeans, which is a Catholic subgroup within the Iraq's Christian minority. There have been Chaldeans in Metro Detroit for a really long time, but that community, especially in Macomb County, has really grown over the past few years. So Jeff just really wanted to know, you know, he is a firefighter, his wife is a teacher, they see and interact with this community all the time. And he wanted to know what sort of attracted Arab immigrants initially to the state of Michigan.
How big is the Arab population in Michigan? Do we even know?
Well, that is a really good question. It's really difficult to get an accurate count on what that population actually is, namely because the U.S. Census doesn't recognize Arab as a separate racial category. Arabs are characterized as white. And over the years, through different waves of immigration, they've been classified in various ways, from white to Asian to Turkic to all sorts of different categorizations. So it's hard to get a grasp on exactly how many Arab Americans we're talking about in Metro Detroit and in the state of Michigan. That researcher Matt Stifler thinks that they may be undercounted by as much as half, but we're talking about from at least 500,000 to about 1 million people, roughly.
So, Sarah, what did you discover? Why is Michigan, and specifically Southeast Michigan, not only Dearborn, but Southeast Michigan, why has it drawn so many immigrants from the Arab world?
Well, it's interesting because in a lot of ways, it sort of mirrors the same story as so many other immigrant groups that have come to this country. But in other ways, it's a really unique story. It has a lot to do with two things, one of which I really discussed in the story, which is the auto industry, and not just the auto industry, but Henry Ford. There is apparently a legend in the local Yemeni community that Henry Ford once met a Yemeni sailor somewhere at port and told him about these jobs in an auto factory that paid $5 a day. And that sailor passed on the word, and that led to chain migration from Yemen and other parts of the Arab world. I should actually back up a little bit, which is to say that Arabs really started the first wave of Arab immigration to Michigan and to the Midwest was actually in the late 19th century in the 1880s, and that was mostly Lebanese and Syrian Christians who worked largely as peddlers and grocers. But that immigration, Arab immigration, really exploded in the beginning of the 20th century when Arabs, like so many other groups, came to Detroit to work in the auto industry, and they really seemed to follow Henry Ford. His first factory in Highland Park was there was an initial Arab community there around that factory. The very first mosque, purpose-built mosque in the U.S. was in Highland Park, built in 1921. But that community didn't last there very long because Henry Ford switched his operations over to Dearborn, to the Rouge plant predominantly, and the Arab community really sort of followed him over there.
Interesting that you say when they initially came over, it was as grocers and peddlers, because the identity really in Southeast Michigan is the fact that it is people who are Arabic who own the gas stations and the party stores and the small groceries, particularly in Detroit. So that hasn't changed.
Yeah, absolutely. That is something that goes back to the very earliest wave of Arab immigration to Michigan, way back to the tail end of the 19th century. And as the researcher I spoke to said, it's not a stereotype that Arabs own most of the liquor stores and convenience stores and gas stations in Metro Detroit. It's pretty much just an accurate fact. So yeah, that is a visible legacy that we can see that continues to this day.
Sarah, is there a sense of Arab identity in Michigan? Do Arabs who follow Islam feel connected with, let's say, those Chaldeans, the Catholic Iraqis, or do they keep more separate?
Again, that's an interesting and complicated question. We should be careful to say that there's not just one Arab American community in Southeast Michigan or in Michigan. There are pockets of different Arab American communities, and Dearborn is the largest and most well-known, but Dearborn is actually a very unique community among Arab American communities, both locally and nationwide, because it is not only heavily Muslim, about 90% Muslim, but is mostly Shiite Muslim. And Shiites are a minority in the Arab world or in the Muslim world. So that is a very unique community that's very different from others. Others are predominantly Christian, as we were talking about Iraqi Chaldeans and Lebanese Christians. And so the interesting thing is that the sort of sectarianism that has characterized the Arab world for the past many years, is whether it's Christian versus Muslim or whether it's Shiite versus Sunni, is largely absent in Metro Detroit. That is not so much an issue, but the community does tend to divide along not only ethnic and religious lines, but along class lines. Some of these communities are very professional, wealthy, well-educated. Others are poor and working-class communities. So there does tend to be more almost of a sort of class divide more than anything. There is a sense, I think, of Arab American identity across religious and racial affiliations, especially here in the post-9/11 era. But a lot of these communities, even though they identify as Arab American, don't really actually interact with each other all that much.
Interesting. Sarah, how well do these Arab immigrants fit when they come into Southeast Michigan as compared to coming into other parts of the country?
Well, they actually do tend to fit in quite well, mostly because, again, there is such a large community already here. There are well-established social service networks that help them adjust and transition successfully to American life. And because people here in Southeast Michigan have been familiar with the Arab American community for so long, it's not really seen as anything particularly new. And the sort of post-9/11 backlash and a lot of the discrimination, while obviously there were issues here like there were anywhere else, they actually weren't as bad here. They weren't as bad, nearly as bad as people think, and probably largely because that community is so well-established and well-integrated into this area that, people didn't see Arabs as being the other as much as they did maybe in other places.
Michigan Radio's Sarah Swick bringing us the first on the MI Curious Reports. You can go to michiganradio.org and click on the link that says, "What are you curious about?" Sarah, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Peg Watson. Contributors are Mercedes Mejia, Emily Fox, Taylor Mattia, Kayla Steinberg, Katie Suha, and Brianna Tinsley. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening.